Welcome to Imagining the Past, the Summer Autumn Season 2025.
HNSA acknowledges the traditional custodians of the land on which we work and live, and recognises their continuing connection to the land, water and community. We pay respects to Elders past, present and emerging.
In this podcast series, we'll be hearing from some of the sessions from the HNSA conference held in Sydney on the 21st and 22nd of October 2023. In this session, View from the East, the absolutely fabulous Claudia Chan Shaw collects the opinions of Xiang Lu, Christopher Chiang and Daryl Lim about writing Asian historical fiction. And a reminder, these are live recordings, so there are a few lamentable glitches.
Thank you very much. It's wonderful to be chairing A View from the East here today. Christopher Cheng, Dao Lim, Xiang Lu, three very, very different writers with three very different styles, but there are common themes throughout their work. So to get started, I'm going to ask each of our writers to give us a synopsis of the books we're talking about today. Now, for all of you, this includes you, Xiang, back in Queensland there. Make it longer than an elevator pitch of five words, okay? But don't make it as long as the real thing. All right, so books. Nice and brief, please. So starting with Christopher Cheng, please tell us, what is Powerful Like a Dragon about?
So Powerful Like a Dragon is actually about one of my uncles. I come from a very big family. My grandfather is one of three brothers, and they all had multiple wives and they had lots of kids. And so there's lots of hundreds of us. And this is one story that my uncle told me 10 years ago at a family reunion. Then I grilled him about our family's time during the Sino-Chinese War, and what happened to our family and how they had to move and escape what was happening to them. So it's a picture book based around, or telling his story, because our family was scattered in different places. It's his story about how they had to leave where they were and escape the whole of the war, World War II.
And we're talking about the second Sino-Japanese War, aren't we?
We are.
Yes. So we're talking about World War II. Siang beaming in from Queensland. Hello, my friend. Hello, lovely to see you there. So what goes on in the whitewash?
Well, the whitewash is oral history, or maybe those in the audience might be, if not familiar with that, a mockumentary. So I was really inspired by things like The Office and even Arrested Development, shows like that, which purport to be a documentary but are really fictional. And I guess the little pitch for The Whitewash is it's essentially Crazy Rich Asians from the Mafia Mexican Trail. There's I guess in the fictional world of The Whitewash, an intention to create a new film, blockbuster film, AAA site film, that stars for the first time an Asian male. So if you could imagine, say, like James Bond or Mission Impossible, but with a Chinese Lee Hato. It's not a spoiler since it's departed. Pretty soon this politics washed up. That's just the start of all. The first is a series of, yes, extent. What we need to gain is supposed to our culture. Jin.
Thank you, Siang. And Daryl Lim, what is the story of the snow in Kuala Lumpur?
So the snow in Kuala Lumpur is starts in the 60s in Malaysia in the kampongs of KL. It follows three boys, basically. Atat, who is bright, driven, kind of conservative and conventional. His cousin Casey, who is his foil, basically, who's the opposite, very violent and rebellious. So they're two ethnically Chinese characters. And then the third major character is Hassan, who comes into KL from the provinces of Malaysia. And the novel basically just follows these three boys as they grow into young men. And I guess the centerpiece of the novel is the 1969 race riots between Malays and Chinese. And after that, basically everything changes. And the novel just looks at how those changes nudge these characters on along a different path from friendship into rivalry.
Mm-hmm. That old chestnut, eh? So The Snow in Kuala Lumpur takes us through from the 1960s into the 1990s in Kuala Lumpur. It's a sprawling family saga. Are there any elements of your own family story in the book?
Yeah, in the details, not so much in the actual narrative. Like my father's family was all very poor. They all grew up in a kampong, no running water, no electricity, that sort of thing. Six siblings in one little atap house, which is like a thatched house on stilts. Yeah, my grandfather, like Kerry Island, features in the novel, which is, it's like a rubber plantation near KL off the coast. And my grandfather spent a lot of time there working as the foreman of the rubber estate. He didn't visit home very much, only occasionally. And yeah, so those elements are in there just to give the novel a bit of various similitude, but the actual narrative is purely fictional.
So we focus on Artat and his cousin KC, and Artat is naive, he's studious, he's quite ambitious, he knows what he wants to do in life, whereas KC is street smart, he's violent, he's destined to take the wrong path. So looking at the two characters, this lovely dichotomy you have between the two, is there any of you in Artat, the studious and you refer to him as conservative one?
Yeah, well, I am quite like that. Especially growing up. In fact, I'm amazed to be here. I would never have dreamed to be someone like this.
Oh, this is where you belong.
Thank you. Yeah, you know, I'm naive. I was very studious growing up. I wouldn't say I'm ambitious, though. That's where we might differ. Like, at least materially speaking, I don't have I'm not chasing a big car or money or status, but.
But maybe some literary goals in there.
Yeah, that's happened recently, but yeah, but I will say one thing. I think that maybe if I had been in Artat's shoes growing up, I might have become more focused on those sort of things. The Malaysian government, the policies being the way they are, that might have pushed me to want certain things that weren't accessible to me. I mean, that's just a thought that I had.
And the character of KC, the wicked cousin, the dangerous one, is there any danger in Daryl Lim?
No, I think you could probably tell there's not much danger at me. Yeah, that's my brother, really, I think. A lot of my writing is a reflection of his personality. And I was fascinated with my brother growing up. He's a younger brother. Yeah, very different.
Interesting. So, Chris, Powerful Like a Dragon. It's a children's picture book set in the Sino-Japanese War. It's based on a true story. So whose story are we telling?
Okay, this is Uncle Al. So, as I said, we've got four branches of the family. So he's my father's cousin. And he told this story at our family reunion. We get together every 5 years, the family, and this year next year they're expecting about 350 of us to fly in from all over the world. And I'm helping him organize it. My other uncle organized it. But Uncle Al told this story and I was fascinated because I've grown up, I'm an Aussie boy. So I've grown up here, and this is a story that I always wanted to find out what happened to our family. Why are we here? And things like that. I knew why we were here because my dad decided to marry the girl across the road instead of going back and working in the family company. That's naughty. And so that's why we're here. And because my grandfather sent all the nieces and nephews and all his kids out here for education. They all came out, including all of these uncles that I'm really close to, except Dad didn't go back, as I said. But then just writing, Uncle Al told us this story at the reunion. My beautiful wife and I were staying with him, as you do. You stay with your relatives when you're traveling around the world. And at 11 o'clock at night, I said, "So tell me a little bit more about this story." And in the iPad sitting over there, I have 2 hours of recorded conversation. Now, that's from one uncle. He then told his brother, and Uncle Herbert said, "Oh, but there's this." And then one of the other uncles said that. So next year when we have our family reunion, they know that they're being grilled by me and they know I'm coming with my iPad and a microphone because there are so many family stories. And because there are so many of us, the rest of the kids and the offsprings and the siblings, none of them know about all of this stuff. So what we're going to be doing is, you know, keeping it preserved, and I'm going to gather it all. And I've got some more books I want to write because this is just one little story that Uncle Al told. And out of that 2 hours conversation, he's talking about all the march through China, what they did to escape when the Japanese came closer and closer. Because basically what happened, a commander came down and said, "You're related to such and such, aren't you?" to another guy. And he said, "Yes." He said, "Tell him we're coming to get him tomorrow." So, of course, Uncle Al's dad just started escaping. So that's how the whole story went.
It's amazing, though, that the Japanese commander came in and gave you a heads up, gave them a heads up and warned them.
And I haven't been able to ascertain why they were warned.
Yes.
Through the rest of the story that Uncle Al told me, this is real, through the rest of it, they knew every time the Japanese army came closer and closer, they just all picked up camp and moved ahead deeper into China or different places.
We just have to read the book. Yes. That's been the whole thing, isn't it? That from this whole weekend, just go out and read the book. Siang, hello in Queensland. I'm guessing that the leading man in the whitewash, who is JK Jr., is not your alter ego in the whitewash. You describe him as he's hot, but he's not the sharpest tool in the shed. So your book is funny, it's inventive. And I should have had an idea from when I very first opened the book and saw the first words, which were, "No, I do not give you permission to interview me for your bullshit excuse of a book." So first words of the book, quote, unquote. So it's an oral history. It's a mockumentary style novel. It tells the story of different voices from many, many different angles. It reads as a screenplay. So how did you arrive at the structure of The Whitewash?
Yeah, I think, I've always had a real existing fit. But if I come to some of the real reason why this book came about, it always comes back to sort of the time that I was thinking about this. Like, I said, just had the title and not much more than that. It was spring around 2017, 2018. And I started thinking about that each week or act of drag, and that it would probably be coming up to the 50th year anniversary of a film pretty soon. Jafik was last year or this year. And I just had this crazy idea, and it just made me laugh. It's actually in the book, but it's admittedly a very small art that this film might be remade. But unlike other remakes, the studios and the producers would try to get as many of the original as possible, even though they're really old. Of course, that doesn't matter because they see the idea that I had, which made me laugh, was that they would really, really try out to find a guy called Bruce Lee, but that his name would be L-E-I-G-H. And that was kind of the genesis to be one ever in a
Because the idea of the whitewash is nothing new. It's been going on forever. Think of Elizabeth Taylor playing Cleopatra. Mm-hmm. Yep. Marlon Brando playing a Japanese gentleman in The Tea House of the August Moon. So it's been going on forever. So your interest in this cringeworthy aspect of Hollywood filmmaking. Oh, here we are, last summer. We could have a whole hour. We could have a whole hour on the whitewashing of Hollywood. Yep. Oh, that we'll come to Ghost in the Shell. What we see are
Ollie's.
So you've had an interest in this cringeworthy aspect of Hollywood filmmaking for a long time, haven't you?
I think so.
It was definitely something that I was interested in, but that I didn't really look at. To notice, are you that excited with Fu Manchu in the 1920s? And that's sort of where I started my search. And it occurred to you pretty quickly that if you think about the timing of Fu Manchu movies, they're really pretty much exactly at the same time. It's silly. And so whitewash has been there since the very early cinema, which is an incredible thing to put. But don't we eat that out? There was this idea, and that just became strengthened with me when was it like Fu Manchu? I said, believe that's the first set. And then I had this idea that maybe we would, in some ways, follow the progression of whitewash throughout cinematics movies. So Fu Manchu in the 20s and 30s, and then I came to realize that Charlie Chan was sort of the next step. And I didn't know about Charlie Chan beforehand, although it's and then incredible, like, cultural phenomenons, like the Chinese showpiece. And yet, even Dax being a slightly better portrayal or kind of portrayal of the Chinese in cinema was still rife with, like, just horrible, horrific racism. And I'd sort of had this idea with X2 just the very beginning of my research that there might be a really neat sort of decade by decade progression. And that was kind of this active literary fate research where I was at the same time writing the story but also doing the research. And this is not a spot. If we think about the history of cinema, it's probably about 100 years. It's approaching 2020s. And this kind of neat kind of parallel there where, and it was kind of following his faith of not knowing exactly where things to go, but feeling like I'm sitting in the right track. And not a lot of people know this, but the Shang-Chi of this is not in the movie, but the genesis of that character in Marvel's history is actually as the enemy son of Fu Manchu. And so it was really interesting day of being in the it's a book at the whitewash with 1920s mention on the 2020s, sort of the progression and movement in issue representation in film, yet still tied to a percept. So it was just incredibly brief. So discover.
So Shang-Chi that we're referring to is the 2021 Marvel film that is all full of, is this Chinese superhero? Isn't he Xiang? So in 100 years on, that's a step in the right direction, is it not? So I'm interested, each of you weave history in and out of your narratives. And I'm interested to see how you approach that research. So Dal, in The Snow in Kuala Lumpur, you paint a very, very vivid picture of life in the kampong, which is the traditional village, told from a young boy's point of view in the 1960s. Growing up in Kuala Lumpur, the street vendors, the colourful lights that are strung up, the local cinema, the hawkers, and then you describe the smell of open gutters, fried chicken, and turmeric. So I'm there. I am immersed in your world. I can smell the streets. So how did you approach your research?
I guess I'm a very visual writer, so I have to see where I'm writing about. So I found an old map of KL online on an online forum. And these forums are like full of older Malaysians who are quite nostalgic, and they'll post pictures of old KL, and they're very meticulous about exactly where these photos took place. So I would print them out, and I just stuck the map in the center of my wall and stuck all the pictures around so that I could really live in that in my head anyway. Yeah, so that's basically how I started. The other thing that was really helpful to me was a memoir by a Malaysian journalist by the name of Rehman Rashid. He's a Malay with some Indian heritage, and he wrote a couple of really good memoirs.
He's passed away, has he?
Yeah. I was sad to hear that. I wanted to meet him one day, but anyway. That was very helpful for me, just because I don't know any Malaysians, which is quite sad and kind of, yeah. So, I mean, my family doesn't know any Malaysians.
It's interesting, isn't it? Because we talk about this division and the 1969 race riots in Malaysia between Malays and Chinese.
That's a
controversy.
Of that
says something about that situation in your own your family situation.
That's exactly right, and that's why that those memoirs were so helpful to me, just to have a very nuanced, complex viewpoint. You know,
what about your own father? Were there any memories from him that helped you?
Yeah, my dad's always talking about the old days. He just like I don't have to do like. Chris's family, probably you just poke them a little bit and just all comes spewing out. Some people like that though. Other people don't have, but like my mum just doesn't live very much in the past at all. So some people are very handy for that sort of thing.
Whereas my dad, and I was telling Claudia, wouldn't talk about the war or anything like that, wouldn't talk about much to do with family, although we as kids grew up in the family house. My grandfather bought the house for all the family, all the kids that came, kids, adults, to come out and live there while they were going to university and things like that. And then my dad ended up buying it. So I went to my uncle in Hong Kong where I saw him last time. I said, yeah, I found your textbooks in the garage. They're like 50, 60 years old. And it's got his name written in them. I should also say they were all infatuated with my mother too, but my dad won. And, but dad wouldn't talk about that. My strong memories is sitting at home watching a black and white movie of World War II. And I'd prodded dad to ask him a few things because it was based in China, what was happening in China. He wouldn't talk about it. But I talked to my uncle, and Uncle Al just sort of blurts this all out, and then all. And dads of Uncle Al's generation, they all contributed to this as well. But because the family is so large, some were actually physically in this war, and whereas dad was in a different part.
Mm-hmm.
So,
do you think your father resents the fact that Uncle Al opened up to you about something that he was so reticent to talk about?
No, I don't think so. I mean, my dad died a few years ago, and we talked a little bit about, you know, what I was got coming up. I mean, honestly, I grew up in a household, and dad's in lots of ways wonderful as a traditional Chinese man, but he's also very not traditional Chinese, but he really would have liked me to not be a children's author because they don't earn very much money. So I could tell him a few things, and he was so proud of me. I had had the books, and he'd sit them on the shelf and just leave them there, and sort of nobody touches them. When he died, I don't know where they actually went, but he sort of had them sitting on the shelf. So he was very proud of me, but he really would have liked me to be something, not a children's author.
My son, the doctor.
Yes, very much, very Asian.
That's so. Powerful Like a Dragon comes from this family oral history. We know it's sitting in the iPad down there on the floor. That's the anecdotal side of the story. So how did you approach the historical side, the Sino-Japanese War?
Oh, that was easy, because after Uncle Al had told this story at the reunion and then to Vinnie and myself sitting at home at 11 o'clock at night. So remember, this is 11 o'clock till 1 o'clock in the morning. He's took this recorded conversation. Next day in the office, we go in and he said, I've got this. And he pulled out photos of the coolies with their clear. He got the map out and he said, this is where we went, Chengdu and all these different places. Now, the interesting thing for me is I've just reread Wild Swans and I'm going through and say, that's where my family was. That's where all those place names kept popping up. So this has a different, very different perception now for me. Wild Swans, and when I first picked it up and I skimmed it then. But yeah, I then also sort of, it's just basically grilling them and finding, because it's a very personal story. So it's very much less that the rest of the war, and it's very much about my family and what my family did and how my family had to escape and pick up the Ford motor lorry, which they then used in the caves to make aluminium extrusions, because one of my uncles ripped out the engine and then thought that's a really good part for making a motor to get things going. They were really inventive, my family. That side of it didn't come to me.
Oh, I don't know. One bit. The author of 40 books? I think that's rather inventive. Siyoung, there are two strains to the whitewash. There's the bitingly funny story about the spy thriller gone terribly wrong against the history of the representation or misrepresentation of Asians in Hollywood. So it's almost like a lesson in film studies, popular culture, and GQ magazine, this book of yours. So how did you approach your research?
I can't remember the precise number of death traits, but there's something like over 200 boats. All boats represent films, and I really watched every single film. So such. One thing that was really important to me in writing this book was to be able to educate as much as entertain, but maybe vice versa. I'm not sure what the sort of percentage of that will be. But, you know, I was really delighted when a friend of mine, Kat, reached out to me and said, you know, I had no idea about this stuff. And I know some of it was real. I mean, most of it seemed to be real. Some of it I know is fictional. So it feel like it made me smarter, also a bit dumber at the same time. And that was kind of the best thing that, you know, another sort of really sort of inch me moment was I sort of got to have a chance to have lunch with Bright, and he had read the book, and I was blown away. And one of the things that he said to me, so about this aunt, was he leaned over and he said, "This, which parts of this are real? Like, what's real in this?" And I was like, "Wow, I just bummixed film legends span, bro." And that was just one of those things where, you know, even in, this might probably let you accept that, but even in the proofreading stage of it all, I came across a pooper and a movie that was I don't really remember watching that, like, since it was really a goal for me to just watch every single one of its films to really understand the entire tapestry. And so I looked it up, I Googled it, I couldn't find it. Eventually I realized that made it off.
So in that research, of course, would have been John Wayne as Genghis Khan in The Conqueror, 1956, voted as the worst film ever made. It's shocking. You would have come across some appalling examples in your research, Siyoung.
Yeah, I had your page open just now. I'm really afraid that I forget it. I remember the character's name. You might be able to hold me for you. It was Ai Yoshi in Breakfast at Tiffany's.
Yeah, oh gosh. Yes,
I have that.
Mickey Rooney.
Not Mickey.
Yeah, and it was just, like, I must have seen him when I was a kid, but I don't remember you know, that sick.
Oh, God, of the
saber. That's why. So,
let's do.
I have that as my screensaver. Yeah. Yeah. I think he looks like me, actually. So
it's blue.
Yeah. You know, watching it as a Nipduff, it was so offensive on every if. And, you know, it really made me think very hard about, you know, in that particular page that I just showed you, there are like three films from 1956 alone that represent really egregious portrayals of Asian characters by white men. And it was coming just this question of like, what's going on? Like, what's happening in Hollywood that sort of has normalized this? And I suppose it's really just when the first step be from a troop, so it lets everyone know that that's okay, then it's really going to take decades and decades and decades to unpick that bushel. And, you know, things are getting better. Someone mentioned Ghost in the Shell. And, you know, it was this kind of thing of like, yes, things are getting, but are they? You know, there's this anecdote from the Ghost in the Shell production. I'm not sure how true this is, but that in the pre-production of Scarlett Johansson, he cast as this, it's a remake of for Japanese anime, and the character is a Japanese character. Scarlett Johansson has been casting, I don't think it's the same person, sorry, the same character, but there is an intention that she portray an Asian character. In the pre-production, they actually use CGI to make up and it's slow. And so it was that thing of, yes, this is 2017, incident being better, but I kind of feel my attitudes aren't really progressing well any quickly.
Yeah.
So.
Appalling. Absolutely appalling. Now, Siang, you came to Australia from Malaysia at the age of 4. Did you embrace your heritage growing up?
It's a great question. You see, the screen's expanded. I heard video is still.
No, we can see you. We can see you.
Right. It's so. No, the sequel answer is what? It could be a very, some of you so growing up being too conscious to embrace the Chinese self. You know, right? You're a kid, I don't want to chill out, at least for my experience. It would have been easier if I was white, you know. I looked around, I have never told this on stage or Zoom, but it was not long after we migrated from Malaysia. I grew up there and, you know, I was suddenly in this home where everyone was white. I was the EHT's kid in not the school, but in my class, sure. And we'd split between into groups, into pairs to draw each other's portraits. And my friends drew my face. And that was the first time I realized how different to everyone, because they draw me with this black nose. And they burst into tears.
Oh.
And, you know, it never occurred to me, like, probably all into the years, it just passed. As so, you know, as kids are in grade one. But that's kind of like a perfect little encapsulation. You know, as a kid, and as an adolescent, it wasn't really until my mid-20s, really, or early 20s, that I started thinking deeply about my culture. And feeling like it was a privilege to have two cultures. Learning more and more about it, this tremendous journey of my life. And I feel so much more complete now. But yeah, it's a really interesting question that you asked, because the similarities that still was drawing up, well, do you feel like that really very much eating?
Like everybody else. Daryl, you also came from Kuala Lumpur, age of 4. You could have got together and played together. Did you embrace your heritage growing up in Australia?
No, I have a similar experience to Siang. I've very much like this was not an, any external pressure. I didn't feel like I was forced to fit in, but just something internally, I just wanted to, I wanted to be more Aussie, I guess you could say. I have a memory of very clearly pretending that I couldn't speak Cantonese anymore. And I pretty much carried that. I internalized it, even though I could. I didn't even speak to my grandmother.
That's cruel.
Yeah. Yeah.
Hmm. Forgot about it.
And Chris, so you're like me, half Chinese, half Caucasian.
Mm-hmm.
So did you embrace your Chinese-ness as a kid?
I was just another kid in the school. What they don't realize is that we went to the same school.
I know.
So we were the high school with our siblings. So we were the Asians in the school, but I was just another kid. We had Italians and Greeks. And that all comes back to the wonderful school we went to, that from your top, you know, you were just another kid in the school. And so everybody just does everything. I didn't pick up that I was any different. Yeah, of course I looked a little bit different, but you know, I mean, they all look a little bit different too. So it was just part of it. It actually, what was really interesting that we were talking about was that I was an adult walking down George Street in the city with an Akubra hat on, and some guy said to me, "You can't wear that." So this is an adult and I'm working in at one of the bookstores, and I thought, oh, that's a bit strange. But it's going to college, going to school. It was just, that was it. But now, like Sian, it's now that in the last bunch of years that I've really been fascinated by my family. Once Uncle Al started talking about this and I could start grilling all my other uncles and finding out bits and pieces, it's been fascinating. You know, I'm first grandson, so I've actually got a full Chinese name. I've actually got a chop. My name that's actually, you know, my legal signature. And I've actually got it written into my contracts now that it goes onto all my books.
Chris, because we're coming close to time, do you speak Cantonese?
No. My father, go through and I'll explain why.
Okay. I don't speak Cantonese either. My mum tried to teach us when we were kids, half Chinese, half Scottish. So the Chinese side of the family I absolutely embrace. The Scottish side, who wants to eat haggis. Food's for the funny side. Mum tried to teach us when we were kids. We went, yeah, yeah, mum, yeah, 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 ha, ha, ha. Can you still speak Cantonese?
No, no.
Daryl?
It was my first language, but I can't, yeah.
It was his first language. Siang, can you speak Cantonese?
No. I guess Cantonese was she.
Oh, what, Hokkien?
Yeah, man. So my parents speak Butcher.
Yeah.
Oh, no, it wouldn't be a yearning sort of regrets. Definitely, yeah. That my parents wasn't able to retain that. My parents did that to a Chinese school. It really didn't take.
I think you see it reclaim your culture in any way that you can.
And for me, it was kind of like advocating Asian representation. So it gives me that throughout.
Yeah, you redeemed yourself, my friend. We're coming very close to time. I just want to ask, so none of us can speak Cantonese, yet we all embrace our heritage later in life. Hindsight's a wonderful thing. You go, oh, geez, one of my great regrets. You had the gift of being bilingual, you goose, and you blew it. So what challenges do the three of you face as Asian Australian writers? And do you call yourself an Asian Australian writer or are you an Australian writer?
I'm an Australian writer through and through.
Challenges?
Challenges for me? No. Look, I'm really privileged that I actually fell into this job, occupation, fun. I was asked to write my first kid's book, and every book I've done has just been put out there, and my publishers eventually have said, yes, fantastic, let's do it. This particular one, I told this story about my uncle escaping the Japanese. I told it to my US publisher, and she says, I want it. So I didn't even talk to anybody here in Australia about it. She just wanted it straight off. And I have my illustrator is actually a Hong Kong Chinese illustrator. She's doing the most awesome illustrations in the traditional Chinese style, which is what I was hoping for. I never tell my illustrators what to do. It's like them telling me what to write. But I failed art in kindergarten too, so that's another reason.
Well, let somebody else do it.
Yeah.
Daryl, any challenges for you? Do you see yourself as an Asian Australian writer or an Australian writer?
I don't know. I'd never really asked myself that question. But I mean, I guess it was when I was trying to get the manuscript published, there wasn't much response from Australian publishers, which is fair enough. It's not like I can understand it's not their market. But as soon as I went to Singapore, I got a lot of responses straight away. So it's just the market, I guess,
yeah.
Audience
yeah.
for it. Yeah.
And what about you, Siang, as a final question for you? Challenges? Yours is an interesting proposition.
Yeah, it's also the CRISPR made for Aki. I got the second book see next year and still through cities. And it's earned it's Art of Age, but I guess it's about a character whose name is Xiang, who's so in the X. And he works at the Chinese cultural in sea, Transi Dohits. And he's essentially gets fired because it's discovered that his monolingual has been lying woolly crest.
And so the backstory, the first, I guess you may see him
I don't know. You sort of see his challenges, and yes, they are. They're also chilebies to explore.
I think you just dobbed us all in, your whole panel. We're relying on Google Translate. Very quickly, are there any questions from our audience? Okay, we'll take go.
We always take the online first. Okay, this is our virtuals. What are your tips for non-Asian writers wanting to incorporate Asian history characters in their stories?
Know your history. It's the same as putting any other culture that you're not part of. Is to know your history, know the characters, know how the characters behave. I mean, it's like Sian was saying with putting these false identities in. You've got to know them. So go and talk to one of them.
Those ancient Romans. That's the one. Go talk to an ancient Roman. Online? Or that was the only online?
Were they after text just there for?
Oh, I mean, I struggled with that myself because I had to write a Malay character, and that's a contentious thing being in my situation sometimes. So, I mean, I couldn't find one to talk to, but I read one, you know, so.
And it was felt as a reader, a very true portrayal of Malaysian life.
Oh, thank you.
And attitudes.
I mean, Hassan, which is a Malay character, is the one character I feel most closely to. So sometimes that helps just putting yourself in a lot of your characters. Yeah.
Siang, what about you?
I think I'd agree, Chris. It's really just doing your research and knowing put the history and average. And really, it's a gut check as well as actually trying to buy it. You know, people, if they'll read, be the readers and just sort of get a sense of like, hey, is this on the right track? Do you might call it sensitivity? So I remember in writing White Dodge that I had a really lovely editor, Kenneth Fan, you're working on now for an export. And she was able to help me spot so many blind spots that I had. In terms of not many AJ characters are also women, and she had such astute sort of queries and would really challenge you to improve. So I think just having a wider beta readership to give feedback can really.
That said, I had an editor who told in one of my historical novels who said they wouldn't have said that, and it was a phrase that every Cantonese minus spoke. And so I had this stand up disagreement with him because he wanted me to pull it out. And I said, no, I'm not pulling it out. So I went further. But it's you've got to hope too that your editor in this situation knows
yes.
the content as well.
Yeah.
One for the quick word, one for the whole panel. Gong en gong, xiu xiu gong chong.
Sius.
Yeah. It's better than I could too. Oh, swear. Honestly.
Mine is much more boring than that. Have you read Yellow Face? And what did you think of that?
I haven't read it. I haven't read it.
I don't know.
Sia, what do you think from my Yellow Face?
Of what Sia has been saying about his book, in that it's written by an Asian writer, but it's about a white character who basically steals a story from her Asian friend. That's it's such an unreliable narrator. It's a fascinating book.
I should say, too, that the reason I don't speak Cantonese is because my father thought it was hugely rude for us to speak Cantonese at home if my mother didn't understand. So, and I have so much love and so much respect for my father for that. I so wish I'd learnt it. Unlike Claudia, I went to Chinese school on Saturday for 1 year.
Yeah, it did. Look where it got you.
Yeah, it is. A little bit further than you, maybe. No. But, you know, that was my dad, and that's why I don't speak Cantonese.
Oh, what a rich, rich, wonderful world we live in. We would encourage anybody from any background to just learn more about your family. It can be a wonderful, wonderful thing. Would you please thank our panel, Christopher Cheng, Dao Lim, and Siang Lu.
Thank you for listening to this podcast, held from the 2023 HNSA conference held in Sydney. Just a reminder that 2025 is conference year, and details will soon be announced. Visit our website, hnsa.org.au, join our Facebook group, and subscribe to our newsletter to be up to date. And please explore our podcast archive, treasure trove of historical ideas. I'm Greg Johnston. It's so good to have your company imagining the past.